Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kate Michaelman, president of NARO, who comments on the Bush administration's anti-choice agenda and the dangers now facing the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, which legalized abortion in 1973. Cindy Folkers of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who describes the campaign now underway to prevent congressional reauthorization of the Price-Anderson Act, which caps the liability of companies operating U.S. nuclear power plants. And Daryl Bodley, whose daughter was killed in the September 11th terrorist attacks, who discusses his recent trip to Afghanistan, where he and other relatives of victims met with those who suffered losses in the U.S. bombing campaign there. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review magazine reports that there is a huge backlog in extradition from Europe of cases of suspected terrorists who are wanted in the US. The problem is that many European nations are refusing to send terror suspects to American courts because the prisoners may face the death penalty. Last fall, 15 members of the European Union worked to create an EU-wide policy on extradition. Yet the talks stalled over capital punishment in the US. As one EU negotiator explained, the death penalty and the military tribunals in the US will make it impossible for an agreement to go as far as the Americans would like. As of early December, 62 people were detained in Europe for being active in the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. They are being held in Spain, France, the United Kingdom, Italy, Germany, and Belgium. In the past, EU nations have agreed to extradite prisoners to American courts only on the condition that they would not be subject to execution. In late November, the European Parliament passed an amendment that makes it clear that a prisoner cannot be extradited to a country that employs the death penalty. For the moment, at least, the US-led war on terrorism is getting bogged down by America's controversial practice of executing those convicted of capital crimes, despite a growing number of nations having in recent decades abolished the death penalty. In October 2000, Nicaraguan garment worker Gladys Manzanares was facing criminal charges for organizing a one-hour strike against her employer, Chentax, a Taiwanese clothing factory located in a free trade zone near Managua, Nicaragua. The charges were later dropped with the help of the New York-based National Labor Committee. A judge ordered that four fired workers be rehired, but only a few months later, the workers had quit because of company harassment, and the factory continued to fire pro-union workers, labeling activists as terrorists. According to the New Internationalist magazine, this story is all too common for thousands of women working at low-wage jobs in free trade or export protection zones. The women are paid starvation wages and sometimes work 18 to 24-hour shifts. In some countries, like Bangladesh, workers in export zones are banned from joining unions. And in other developing nations where unions are legal, factories just move when workers join trade unions. Fortunately, more unions are recognizing the plight of women workers. On March the 8th, International Women's Day, the International Conference of Free Trade Unions will launch a three-year effort to double the number of women members of unions. Increasingly, many women now work in the informal sector, where they make clothing or toys in their homes or in a small workshop. As a result, they are tougher to organize and can be isolated from other women workers. Mother Jones magazine reports that federal prosecutors have dropped felony charges against 15 anti-nuclear activists and two journalists who were arrested near a missile defense test site during a July 14, 2001 protest at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. A plea bargain was made with Greenpeace USA. The protesters pled guilty to trespassing charges and faced the prospect of serving several months in federal jail. Greenpeace agreed to pay $150,000 in damages and signed off on an injunction that prevents the group from staging any future illegal protests at U.S. military bases. Prosecutors in the Los Angeles U.S. Attorney's Office say the stiff charge was the result of the presence of Greenpeace activists inside the test site, a charge that Greenpeace denies. Now, Greenpeace says the harsh felony charges were part of a heavy-handed campaign to crush political dissent. Greenpeace spokesman Carol Gregory stated, "Our guys were among the first victims of this trend. The felony charges are a worrying sign for the future of non-violent protest in the United States." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Thank you.
January 22nd marked the 29th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in 1973, which recognized a woman's right to choose as a fundamental liberty. However, under George W. Bush's current anti-choice agenda, freedom to keep abortion and birth control safe, legal, and accessible for women faces more danger now than any other time in the last three decades. President Bush is making every attempt to stack the federal courts with anti-choice judges. Bush's nomination of ultra-conservative Charles Pickering to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is part of a continuing effort to hasten the reversal of Roe v. Wade. As a Mississippi state legislator, Pickering called for a constitutional convention to propose an amendment banning abortion. He also advocated passing amendments to reverse desegregation and separation of church and state court decisions. Kate Michaelman is the president of the National Abortion Reproductive Rights Action League, or NARAL. She spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about how women's constitutionally protected freedom of choice is one vote away from being overturned.
The most important thing to remember about Roe versus Wade is that it removed the government out of the decision-making about childbearing. Over the 29 years since Roe, there have been very serious campaign to erode this right of choice, to put state governments and federal governments back into the business of deciding for women, of dictating to women which decisions she should make. I would argue that today, in 2002, women have fewer reproductive rights than their mothers did a year after Roe versus Wade, which struck down all the laws across the country that made abortion illegal and forced women into the back alleys of this nation where they were losing their lives to illegal, unsafe abortions. And today, the court, the Supreme Court, is divided 5-4 on legal abortion. So the court is only one vote away from overturning that decision, and at least one, and probably more than one, of the 9 Supreme Court justices is likely to retire in the next couple of years. And President Bush is and has long been opposed to the right of women to have an abortion. And if a Supreme Court justice retires, Bush can nominate a justice to the court who also opposes abortion and Roe versus Wade. And Roe will be overturned and a woman's right to choose will be rolled back.
George Bush, almost immediately when he came into office, imposed the gag rule, which essentially cut off funds to organizations overseas that provided abortion counseling. How has this affected a woman's right to choose internationally?
Well, that was a very, very devastating decision to restrict funding to these organizations in developing world that provide these family planning services to women and forced these healthcare programs to either be gagged and not give women information if they do face a crisis pregnancy about how to get an abortion safely, because many of these countries, abortions are illegal and women are dying. Or they have to agree to it to get the money. It's a terrible situation.
Well, he has a clear anti-abortion agenda. He's already sent 66 nominations to the Senate Judiciary Committee,
right,
and these judicial appointees serve for life.
That's
so
right.
Even after he leaves office, just a few appointments by him could result in federal circuit being dominated by right-wing judges. One of these nominations is Charles Pickering. Mm. Do you want to talk a little bit about that in his George Bush's ongoing anti-abortion agenda?
Yes. A very important point you raise, that not only is the Supreme Court at risk, but the lower federal courts, where the right to choose is really being interpreted and worked out, and where it's the courts of last resort for many women across the country. There are lots of vacancies on those courts, and the president has nominated a number of people. In fact, the majority of people he's nominated have a view that women do not have a constitutional right to choose to be free from government intrusion into our private lives, and will rule in that way on the court. Charles Pickering will be up for a hearing February the 7th. It's his second hearing. He is from Mississippi. He's a district judge right now. He has, over the course of his life, both as a politician and a senator in the state of Mississippi and as a political activist, he has worked hard to do what he could to take away the right of choice from women and to have government make abortion illegal again. He led the Republican Party committee in 1976 that resulted in the Republican Party for the first time adopting a commitment to ending legal abortion through a human life amendment. He opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. He is bad on civil rights. This is a man who should not sit on any court that rules on constitutional rights anywhere. And he is Trent Lott, who is the minority leader in the Senate, his hand-picked nomination. And Trent Lott is literally threatening members of the Senate to vote in favor of Charles Pickering Sr. or else.
The Fifth Circuit is one of the crucial areas, yes, courts in the United States. It consists not only, I think you mentioned Mississippi, but also Louisiana
and
Texas.
It is the circuit that has challenged a woman's constitutional right to choose more than any circuit.
The age of the population right now that remembers Roe v. Wade and prior to that and the struggles that it took to make that a reality, there's a lot of younger women, I would think, that don't know of those struggles and may not see this as important or as critical. Mm-hmm. Do you agree, and what would you say to them who are listening to this program?
I do absolutely agree. Younger women who take for granted their right to choose and think it can never happen that we would lose this right have got to understand that freedoms last only as long as we are willing and able to defend them.
That was Kate Michaelman, president of NARAL. For more information, call area code 202-973-3000 or visit the League's website at www.naral.org. A bill to reauthorize a little-known law that caps the liability of utilities operating nuclear plants is working its way through Congress. The Price-Anderson Act, as it is known, has already been passed in the House and will soon be debated in the Senate as part of the Omnibus Energy Bill. The outcome could determine the future of nuclear power in the U.S. Price-Anderson, which became law in 1957, was drafted to protect utility companies generating electricity with nuclear power, a then untested and potentially dangerous technology. The legislation, which limits the losses of investors, was critical in attracting financing for the fledgling industry. 103 nuclear plants currently operate in the U.S., with a liability cap of about $10 billion per incident. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Cindy Folkers of the Washington, D.C.-based Nuclear Information and Resource Service about the role the Price-Anderson Act plays in making the nuclear power industry viable, the new generation of nuclear plants which could be built with its renewal, and the campaign being organized to prevent the Act's reauthorization.
Price-Anderson Act was actually first enacted in 1957, and it does two things as far as providing the nuclear industry subsidy. The first subsidy is providing insurance liability coverage for the nuclear industry in case of a catastrophic accident that it could not otherwise afford to purchase and, in fact, may not have even been available for it, to the tune of between $366 million and $3.4 billion per year for all the reactors in this country. The second subsidy that it's provided since it was enacted was a cap on the liability of the nuclear utilities should they have a catastrophic accident. It's varied throughout the years, but currently it is set at about $9.5 billion, so that any cost for a catastrophic accident, either in lives or land or just economic costs in general, would have to come from somewhere other than the nuclear utilities. So they don't get to pay any more than $9.5 billion. And that sounds like a lot of money, but in fact, 1982, Sandia National Laboratories, which is a national lab that was involved with weapons production and is a contractor, part of the Department of Energy, did a report in which they stated that catastrophic accidents could reach as high as $600 billion. Which is adjusted for today's inflation, so that's current dollars. So currently, where the law is in Congress, the House took up and passed H.R. 2983, which was the Price-Anderson Renewal Act reauthorization, which reauthorizes the law. And I should state that this particular law would cover only nuclear reactors to be built from August 2000 on. So, in other words, all current reactors are grandfathered in under the Price-Anderson Act, so that the whole purpose for renewing the Act is to usher in a generation of quote-unquote new reactors.
Once a plant is built and it's covered under, you know, previous years under the Price-Anderson Act, it's covered forever for the life of the plant, even if the Price-Anderson Act expires?
Yes, that means that the whole reason for wanting to get this Act passed so quickly is to ensure that there will be liability coverage for future nuclear reactors. There's a couple of designs for the reactors on the table. The one that we think is most likely to get built and the one that we've been hearing the most about is the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor, which is PBMR. And the industry calls this design an inherently safe design, and that's just simply not true because this particular design has no containment. So I will remind you that the Sandia report that estimated an accident could reach as high as 600 billion was a report that was done assuming that the reactors of the current generation had containment. So there really hasn't been an assessment done of the PBMR cost of and consequence of an accident.
Why do you suppose that there was so little or no debate in the House before they passed this bill?
They brought this bill up under suspension of the rules, which basically meant 20 minutes of debate on either side and no ability to add any sort of amendments or change the language in any way. And I think that the reason that they did that is that the Bush administration favors nuclear power. And, you know, Vice President Cheney basically said himself that there will be no more nuclear reactors built in this country unless Price-Anderson passes. So politically, they did it so that they could have as little debate on this issue as possible and keep it as far from the public eye as possible. We're trying to, first of all, raise public awareness of this issue, because a lot of people don't realize that this is happening and that this would very well cause a new generation of reactors to come online, which at this point are, you know, like I said, not even off of paper design. They haven't even been tested. We're trying to inform people about Price-Anderson and to also let them know that this also bears on the terrorist issue. I think a lot of the folks in Washington, D.C., a lot of the leaders aren't necessarily aware of exactly what Price-Anderson does or what it could mean. And the other side of it is that, you know, there are a lot of, for instance, Republicans who I would consider free market gurus, as it were. I mean, this is what they say. This is what the pinnacle should be. We should have free market with little government interference. But when you bring up a bill such as Price-Anderson, which is an obvious subsidy to an industry that's had this subsidy for 50-odd years and has, you know, pretty much failed miserably economically, not to mention environmentally, that you would think that they would slap it down. And I'm quite shocked, frankly, that a lot of the people who espouse to support a free market would also, in addition, support this subsidy to the nuclear industry, which does not deserve it.
That was Cindy Folkers of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Contact the service by calling area code 202-328-0002 or visit the group's website at www.nirs.org. Across the country, relatives of people killed in the September 11th terrorist attacks mostly grieve in private, isolated from the U.S. war in Afghanistan, intended to capture and punish those responsible for the carnage. But a unique group of U.S. citizens who lost loved ones during September's attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania expressed their grief publicly when they recently traveled to Afghanistan to visit the other Ground Zero. Global Exchange, a San Francisco-based social justice advocacy group, organized this victim-to-victim delegation, which brought four Americans who lost family members in the terror assault to Afghanistan, where they met Afghans whose own relatives were killed or injured in the U.S. bombing campaign there. While in Afghanistan, Global Exchange delegates delivered compensation claims to the U.S. Embassy in Kabul on behalf of Afghans they met who lost loved ones or homes as a result of American bombs. Estimates of civilian deaths in Afghanistan resulting from U.S. airstrikes range from 1 to 4,000. Daryl Bodley, whose daughter was killed in the September 11th attacks, was among those who recently traveled to Afghanistan with Global Exchange. Diora, Bodley's 20-year-old daughter, boarded United Airlines Flight 93 on the morning of September 11th. Her plane was hijacked and later crashed in Pennsylvania, killing all on board. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bodley, a professor of music in California, who talks about his late daughter, his experience in Afghanistan, and his desire that aid reach the victims of violence wherever they are.
Well, she seemed to be developing into quite the adult person. She was 20 years old and went to Santa Clara University, and she was majoring in psychology with a little bit of French. Along the way, she did work for an elementary school, which was just down the street from her university, teaching second-grade kids to read. She was a helping person. She also liked to listen to her friends. Her friends found her the person they could go and talk to, you know, just to work things out. And that was the kind of person she was.
What are some of the experiences you had in meeting Afghan victims of the violence there in the recent U.S. bombing? Maybe you could recount some of your encounters.
Well, there were two in particular. I think we went and saw five families, and one of them, a man, had lost his daughter, 5 years old, to a bomb. And so he was in quite a similar situation to me. And there's a picture or two in the press of me and him consoling each other. I felt his grief, he felt mine, and he was also telling us about the other kinds of difficulties that were going on with his family as a result of the bombing, because unlike us, the bombs that were dropped in on homes were dropped on people where people were living. The World Trade Center, well, it's a tragic devastation. It's a little different. I'm not saying it's any less than sitting in your home and a bomb dropping on it. Another family was a woman who had a 20-year-old son. I believe her husband had been lost to the Mujahideen wars earlier, and so the 20-year-old son was the breadwinner of the family. It's very difficult for a family without a male breadwinner to survive in Afghanistan. It's just the culture. And so she was bereft. She had no possibility, or at least in the near future, of being able to earn any income. And her house was destroyed. Her 20-year-old son had been sitting in the second floor where the bomb dropped on his head.
Professor Bodley, as you yourself, I'm sure, have noticed, neither the U.S. government or the U.S. press has talked much about the civilian casualties in Afghanistan resulting from the U.S. bombing campaign there. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about that in terms of having visited there yourself and seen it up close?
Well, I think it's probably typical of what happens after bombing campaigns. And it's time for the information to be brought out. It's time for the discussion to begin, and I think that it's one of the issues that should be brought out in the international discussions that came out of Tokyo, where the two kinds of damage in Afghanistan are the systemic damage that's occurred over 23 years of war, and in addition to that, or on top of that, is what I call the last chapter, which is the damage which has been inflicted as a result of the bombing campaign. And it's not just people who have lost family members. There's also displaced people who have been displaced by the violence over the 23 years and also by the bombing within Afghanistan. We saw internally displaced people's camp where people had come because they couldn't live where they were living anymore. Their houses had been destroyed by violence over 23 years or bombs, and their farms were all mined and they couldn't farm there anymore. And they have no place to go, and the food they've been given by the aid organization so far is going to run out, and the places that they've been staying are going to be have to be given back to those people who let them use them temporarily. So I think that the situation is dire there.
And do you think U.S. policy in terms of aiding Afghanistan to rebuild after the devastation of the bombing and all these decades of war is going in the right direction, or what's your view of that?
Well, we started off very low numbers. I'm afraid that we do have to talk about numbers. I call them the M money and the B money. And the M money, we've now offered up something over $200 million, but that does not compare to the B money, the billions of dollars that have been spent on the war campaign. And so I think that ultimately we just need to keep pressing the focus now on developing systems of caring and assisting people just as well developed as the systems we have for making war and military action.
A question about your own view of how to prevent terrorist acts that claim innocent lives, as we saw on September 11th and countless other incidents through the decades. How do you think our country should approach that issue of preventing future acts of terrorism?
Well, I have a little mantra that I developed, and it came to me, I think, probably about within the week after September 11th. So if you don't mind, I would repeat that now.
Please.
And that is we need to search for the root causes of the problem, and the first of those is the lack of respect and love for all human beings by all human beings. The second is the lack of peacefulness within human beings, which would lead to the peace among human beings. And the third is the lack of sharing equitably the resources of the world among all people of the world, all life on the world, and the world itself. So that's my take on it.
That was Daryl Bodley, who recently returned from a Global Exchange-sponsored delegation to Afghanistan. Contact Global Exchange by calling 1-800-497-1994 or visit their website at www.globalexchange.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Monat, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.